The Pre-Made Year, session number 575. Hello, and welcome to The Pre-Made Years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Welcome to The Pre-Made Years. Thank you so much for joining me today. I have a wonderful guest, Daryl, who's going to join us and talk about his journey from not wanting to go to medical school, to wanting to go to medical school, to not going to medical school, to finally going to medical school, and the journey that he has taken all along the way, leading to the medical student that he is today. Let's go and jump in. Say hello to Daryl. Daryl, welcome to the Pre-Med Years. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thank you for having me.
I'm excited to chat with you. We have come to know each other through the Pre-Med Hangout, which is the Facebook group that I run. You are very opinionated and have tons of wisdom and share your knowledge with lots of students, which I love. So I'm excited to have you here. And you've had a journey in your life, and you are an older, non-traditional medical student now. When did you realize you wanted to go to medical school?
Man, you know, it's something that I think that I've always wanted to do. But in my youth, I didn't have the maturity. So I graduated from high school in 1989 and promptly got to Texas Southern University and fell in love with this 21-year-old track star from Jamaica, Nigeria, somewhere. I was 17 at the time. And promptly went on to fell out of school. And so, you know, I was on football scholarship. My family didn't have the money to pay for me to go to school. And I remember my dad telling me, you know, you need to grow up and be a man. We don't have the money to have you playing around. We can't afford for you to come back home. We can't afford for you to be in school. We can't pay for that out of pocket. So he said, figure it out. And so I ended up enlisting in the Army. I trained as a combat medic. And that was really sort of what really put the seed in my mind that, hey, medicine is a career that I could go into. You know, I wasn't thinking about money or prestige or any of these things that people sometimes talk about, but just, you know, having a skill set to be there for people at the right time, in the right place, in the right way was a really powerful motivator for me.
Yeah.
Still didn't have a lot of knowledge about what I needed to do to actually get to this thing called medicine.
Yeah.
That being said, you know, I went through my military career. When I was discharged, I started working at the Baylor College of Medicine as a medical assistant, actually for the cardiology clinic. That was absolutely awesome.
Yeah.
I worked with a lot of residents, you know, who showed me a lot of things. And, you know, they were all like, yeah, you need to do this thing called medicine. And I still think that I had a lot of growing to do, though. You know, some confidence issues.
How old were you at that point?
Oh, gosh. So this was 1999. So between 97 and 99. So I was still in my 20s.
Okay.
Somewhere there.
Yeah. So later 20s.
Yeah.
And when you joined the military, did they put you in combat medic, or did you have some inclination already to the healthcare thing? And you're like, that career field looks kind of cool.
Well, so, okay, you're going to laugh at this. So, you know, like I said, Dad had told me, he said, you can't come back home. He said, you can sleep under a bridge, sleep out in the field, whatever. You just can't come home. So I just knew I needed to do something. So I went down, took the ASVAB, and scored well enough to actually enlist in the Navy's nuclear program.
Okay.
You know, I was like, you know, doggone, you know, sleeping in a submarine under the ocean for 4 months, and that didn't sound cool. So then, you know, I went and talked to a Marine recruiter thinking, you know, like Marine infantry, yeah, that sounds really neat. But at that time, they were only recruiting for, I think, computer something and cannon crew members. And so I went and talked to an Army recruiter, and they said, well, you know, we have slots for combat medics and culinary whatever. And I was like, well, culinary doesn't sound cool, but combat medic, yeah, that sounds neat.
Okay.
And that's literally how I got into it. But when I was at Fort Sam, and I really wish I could remember our two platoon sergeants' names who are our trainers. They had been medics for years, obviously. they really talked a lot about the responsibility and the honor and privilege it is to be able to take care of people.
Yeah.
And again, those kind of things just really made a huge difference, you know, on my young mind. And since that time, I've been sold.
Yeah. So the ASVAB, my quick story about the ASVAB in Florida, I took it in high school. It was like something all the high school students took. I got kicked out of my ASVAB.
What did you do, man?
They thought I was cheating because, you know, there's like the math section where it's like 100 math problems or whatever it is and how, like, a short period of time. And they're easy math problems. It's nothing like ridiculous calculus. And so I'm speeding through it, doing as best I can. They're like, okay, pencils down or turn the page or whatever it was. And I was like, I'm kind of a perfectionist. Like, those bubbles aren't very good. So I'm just making my bubbles look good. And the lady comes up to me. She's like, put your pencil down. Get out of here. I'm like, okay. And now you can call me Major Gray because I still went to military anyway.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my ASVAB story. So you kind of, I don't know, lucked into this fate, whatever you want to call it, that you went to a couple of different places and they're like, they didn't have the right thing for you, and you found the right thing for you.
Yeah. You know, my dad has always told me, you create your own path if that's what you have to do. And Dad certainly was somebody who created his path. So he graduated from Texas Southern University's College of Pharmacy. I guess that was, 1970, year before I was born. And he was one of the first African-American pharmacists to start to work at the Houston VA.
Wow.
Initially, when he graduated from pharmacy school, none of the hospitals in Houston would hire him. Or, for that matter, many Black pharmacists. In fact, his first job out of pharmacy school was working for the Poison Control Center down at UTMB. So he's driving from Houston down to Galveston every day, you know, for about a year. And, you know, he didn't like that. So he said, I'm going to create a path in the pharmacy. And I don't, you know, it would take him to tell the story, but he created his path to the VA. And all his life, he's just created his path to the things that he's wanted to do. And that's rubbed off on me. And that's what I've done. You know, when I decided to go back to my undergrad studies at Arizona State University, the pre-health office was like a lot of pre-health offices, right? If you weren't that 4.0 student who had zero red flags, they weren't going to have anything to do with you.
Yeah.
There were a lot of resources that the pre-health office had that I couldn't get access to. So I said, well, shoot, I'm going to get my own resources.
I hate that.
You know, it sucks. But, you know, my wife and I were at the graduation of one of our mentees who was also an Arizona State University graduate. She was, 3.7, 3.8 GPA. And the pre-health advisor told her, no, I don't think that you're going to be a good medical student. Well, now she's a doctor who's just graduated from Albert Einstein University College of Medicine.
A couple years too early. Missed out on that free tuition.
Right. Yeah. But I think that she's going to be.
Should be all right.
That's just what I've done. You know, I email people, I search the internet. I'm not afraid to speak up for the things that I think that I want to do.
Yeah. Well, let's rewind a little bit. You kind of fast forwarded going back to undergrad. So you're working at Baylor in the cardiologist office or cardiologist floor. When did you go, you know what, maybe I should give this college thing another try?
So in 2005, I guess that was January, by that point in time, I was like, I need to go back to school.
With the idea of giving your shot at going to medical school?
So it was still in the back of my mind, but by this point, there was a recognition for me that if I was going to do anything to increase my earning potential, I need to get a degree.
Okay.
So medicine was still back there, but it wasn't like, boom, front and center.
Yeah.
At that time, it was still more of a, okay, I'm tired of, I think when I was working at Baylor, I was maybe making $15 an hour. Or something like that.
So it was a logistical decision.
Right.
Okay.
Right. But then, you know, once I started at Arizona State University, you know, I attended a few of the AMSA meetings the pre-health club.
Yeah. Can I just mention real quick? Sorry to interrupt. ASU was my dream school growing up. Growing up in Southern California as a baseball player, I'm like, I want to go to Arizona State and play baseball.
Well, you know, we do have this reputation of being the party school of the Southwest. And I honestly don't even, you know, because originally I wanted to go to the University of Arizona, but ended up at ASU. So I don't know. But yeah, so I attended some of the, a few of the AMSA meetings that we had.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, you know, let me just resurrect, dust off this dream. And, you know, one of the things, in fact, that first meeting I attended, I remember it was a physician from Banner Good Sam, you know, who was speaking about his path to medicine. And so he said, you know what, you know, one of the things that you need to do is to start getting some sort of clinical shadowing experience to see if this is really something that you want to do. You know, I had the military combat medic experience and I worked at Baylor, but, you know, I think that getting additional experience was going to be a good thing for me. So I got a job at the Banner Poison Control Center, which was really neat because, you know, I got to make some clinical decisions regarding minor poisonings and things like that. But more importantly, that actually opened up some doors for me to start doing some shadowing in the ER at Banner Good Sam. And that was absolutely awesome. I was like, oh yeah, this whole emergency medicine thing, this is like the coolest thing in the world. I found that a lot of the physicians and residents were willing to take me under their wing, and they would show me things that, you know, many undergrads couldn't get access to. And so I think from that point, I was like, yeah, medicine is what I want to do.
Yeah.
Medicine is it.
Okay. So you're back in kind of the general terms, freshman, sophomore, how early in your undergrad journey or re-journey were you?
Well, like I said, since I had failed out of Texas Southern, I mean, I left TSU with a 1.67 overall GPA. So I was
crushing it.
Right. Like, bro, I got an F in weight training. I remember my dad telling me, like, how in the hell do you get an F in weight training of all things? Right. So, yeah, no, I essentially was starting all over again.
Okay.
Yeah.
So all over again, and then relatively quickly, it was like, yeah, this is my path. I'm going to be a doctor. It's been a few years since you made that decision. You're in medical school now, so there's been some deviations on that path. Let's talk about kind of the first big deviation. Where did the first big deviation come from?
Like I said, when I was an undergrad, I didn't have guidance from the pre-health office. Mm-hmm. I just sort of had there's like this nefarious thing out there. I want to go to medical school.
Yeah. And I apologize. I wasn't around yet. I was in medical school myself. So my podcast and books weren't available yet. So it's all my fault, Daryl.
It would have been really helpful to have had that back then because, you know, I didn't know, for example, how expensive applying to medical school was.
It's so crazy.
My first inkling into how expensive this is, I sat for the MCAT. And that was 2010. And I knew I needed some kind of a course. And so I heard people talking about Kaplan and Princeton Review. So, you know, I signed up for the Kaplan course. And that was at that time, right around $1,600. I wasn't where, you know, I had a little student job on campus that paid maybe $12 an hour, 20 hours a week. I wasn't getting any support from, you know, family or anything like that. I ended up missing 2 months of rent and didn't buy groceries for a month to make my payments towards the Kaplan course. So started doing some more research and found out, well, dang, you have to actually pay for these medical school applications, right? Because I thought maybe it would be kind of like undergrad, like, you know, maybe you just pay $20 or $30 or whatever for the application. It was like, no, this is a whole lot of money.
20 or 30, you're right, it's $20-$30 per school.
Right. Because I for example, this whole thing of doing a primary application and then secondaries and then paying for interviews and all these things, like that, like I couldn't wrap my mind around all of those different things. Simultaneously, you know, since I was finishing undergrad, I remember getting that first loan from the U.S. Department of, I'm sorry, not loan, but letter from the Department of Education saying, you know, congratulations on finishing undergrad. Your loans are now due.
The clock is ticking, sir.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And so there were, you know, so for me at that time, there were financial considerations that I felt I needed to address before I could even think about, you know, a medical school. In retrospect, had I had good advising, I think I would have been ready to go to medical school then.
Yeah.
My MCAT score, it wasn't a horrible score. I think it's like a 28S or a 28T.
28, a 28 is about a 504 these days, yeah. Somewhere around there. I was a 27, so you beat me.
Yeah, this was me not being fully engaged with the preparation because, like I said, I had these financial issues.
And how'd you do GPA wise that second go round?
I finished at Arizona State with a cumulative of a 3.18.
Okay.
So yeah, wasn't horrible, you know. I probably, you know, could have used some academic renovation at that time. Mm-hmm. But then again, I mean, stranger things have happened, right? Again, having good advising, developing a good strategy to apply to medical school, that might have made the difference. But I didn't have any of that knowledge at that time.
Yeah.
So at that time, one of my undergrad professors said, you know what, you have the aptitude to teach. He said, you know, I see how you teach your peers, how you tutor them. You know, why don't you consider teaching as a potential career option? So didn't even have my master's degree yet. And so I started teaching public health classes for the university. And that ended up being a career, you know, until 2021, when I actually got into medical school.
Okay. Why did you not try to break away sooner? Is it the typical kind of golden handcuffs? You're making a salary and it's hard to get away from that?
Yeah. You know, it's like I said, as you get older, you know, you start accumulating more responsibilities. And like you say, you're making money. And honestly, academia is a pretty decent life.
Yeah.
You know, if you get to a point where you make tenure, you know, it's not a bad life. Mm-hmm. But for me, medicine was still like, the dream wouldn't let me go.
Or the nightmare, depending on how you look at it.
Well, yeah, because some days, you know, when you're sitting in anatomy, you're like, well, damn it, why am I doing this? Right.
Oh, man.
It wouldn't let me go.
Yeah.
But like I said, it, you know, as you get older, it does become harder to break away. And what I found was that when I finally made the decision to apply, I had to make a really conscious effort to say, okay, I'm applying. I'm going to break away from this career. And that's hard to do. You know, when you're mm-hmm. used to making good money, you're used to being that adult, so to speak, you know, because one of the things I tell other older mentees, when you go back to medical school, there's definitely a hierarchy. And even though you may have had a career where maybe you were the one in charge, you were the one calling the shots, you come back to medical school, you're starting over at the bottom.
Yep.
You're like everybody else. You don't get special privileges. Age doesn't mean a whole lot here. You know, you've got to, you know, earn your dues and all that stuff like everybody else. And that can be kind of hard.
Yeah. How did you overcome a very common kind of thing that students and parents and advisors will tell people who are applying to medical school, have a plan B. You were living your plan B. How did you break out of that mindset of like, oh, it's fine if I don't get in, I'll just keep teaching? Because it sounds like you made a very firm decision that you were going to go to med school.
Yeah, I did. For me, I think it was just, how would I say, have you ever had something that you wanted so bad in life that until you did it, you didn't rest? And that's what it was like for me. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed my teaching career, loved teaching, loved my students, loved seeing them reach their goals. But every night when I would lay down, medicine was still in the back of my mind. My wife would tell you, it's all I really talked about. I didn't rest. And when you're not living your purpose, when you're not living and walking your path, you will not rest. Mm-hmm. It took a lot of courage for me, I think, to break away from a safe, secure career field. I mean, you know, I'll be very honest and frank. When you come into medicine as an older student, ageism is something you deal with. I've had a faculty member at my school tell me, that he thinks I'm too old to be doing this. He told me that point blank. I've read stories of people my age and older trying to get residency, and one individual in particular, you know, ended up having to file a lawsuit against a program in Oklahoma because they wouldn't, you know, take her because of her age. Perfectly capable, grade wise, had great board scores, but her age. And so there are things that I'm fearful of, but at the same time, you can't live in fear. And if you have an opportunity to grasp a dream, take it now, because eventually, for all of us, the clock runs out. Eventually get too old to do these things that you want to do.
Yeah. Do you have kids that add to the complication of this?
No.
Okay.
Me and my wife have two cats.
So that makes things easier, and the decisions and finances are a little bit easier because of that.
Absolutely.
What did your wife think when you were like, hey, hon, I want to go to med school?
Oh, my wife has actually been my biggest supporter. So, okay, if we rewind a little bit back to 2012, my wife said, you know what? I know you want to go to medical school. I know you haven't had a lot of support and guidance. She told me, she said, I'm going to get a job at a U.S. medical school, and I'm going to learn what we need to do to get you to a medical school. So she applied for a position at Western University out in L.A. I think it was, what was her job? She was like career services for students who didn't get a residency. So her job at the time was to help those students prepare for the scramble. I think it was called the scramble at that time.
Yep.
But that was her first job in U.S. Med Ed. And after she finished her first doctorate, she was offered an assistant professor role at ATSU SOMA, and they put her on the admissions committee. And that is what actually helped me to craft that winning medical school application. She was able to use what she learned sitting on the admissions committee for me to be able to craft my application. So if it wasn't for her, I don't know that I would be a medical student now.
Yeah. When you made that decision to kind of stop teaching, I was going to say give up. You didn't give up on teaching. Stop teaching. And try to go back to apply to medical school. What were those first steps like? Did you have to go take more classes? What did you need to do there?
Yeah, absolutely needed to take more classes because, you know, as you know, you're still going to be judged on your undergrad grades, even if you have a, you know, because by that point, I actually had a master's degree in pharmacology, and I've done reasonably well. But the advice that I was getting anyway was, well, you still need to do something for that undergrad GPA.
Yeah.
Some schools you may not even pass screening for. After seeing all the things that you shared over the years, I recognize that that may not have been the very best advice. But needless to say, I went back to Arizona State University and picked up, oh gosh, I think it was 24 or 30 credits of a science coursework, and did really well. You know, I ended up with a 3.7 or 3.8 or something like that. And I had to retake the MCAT, of course. And there were still, you know, financial issues, you know, going on, you know, during this period of time. My mother-in-law passed away, and, you know, so there were some behavioral health, mental health issues that, you know, me and my wife needed to deal with. We had taken in one of her young cousins, and we were still trying to recover financially from all of that. And then, of course, in 2020, COVID hit.
That little thing called COVID.
Yeah, that shut down a lot. But by 2020, I said, you know what, this is my time to apply. So, you know, I took the MCAT, applied to medical school, and ended up successfully. But I had to go and do some academic renovation first, though.
Yeah. What was it like to finally get that acceptance?
Man, I don't know who was the happiest, me or my wife. I just remember my wife falling to her knees in prayer. We were both crying. I drank a bottle of champagne by myself.
Liver. I'm going to learn how to fix you.
right. Little self-disclosure, you know, I'm not a drinker, and I was wasted, you know, my wife.
You deserved it.
Yeah, but it was a really, really happy moment. It was very humbling. One of the top 10 moments in my life, I would say.
Phone call or email?
How did they let me know? Well, so ATSU SOMA was the first acceptance I had, and they let me know by phone.
Okay.
And I think the other three were emails.
Okay. So four acceptances.
Yeah.
What was the interview trail like? I kind of skipped over the application process and interview trail. What was the interview trail like being an older black man on the interview trail? Are they getting weird looks? Like, what are you doing here?
Well, so for starters, you know, all of my interviews, again, were done during COVID. So that was just a weird sort of space period. And again, luckily, my wife trained me really well to do the whole virtual interview thing because everything was virtual. Mm-hmm. For the most part, the interviews were okay. I had one interviewer who questioned my age. Mm-hmm. It was a pretty overt sort of thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask, who are you? How dare you? Or is it like, hey, have you thought about this at your age? And
So at this particular school, it was a little bit of both.
Okay.
You know, I remember him saying, well, you know, we see that you had a long, successful career teaching.
Which informs us, a.k.a. you're old.
Right. And that, yeah, right. And he was like, well, teaching is going to be easier than medical school. How do you think you'll keep up with your younger peers?
Okay.
Is what he asked me, and point blank. But after seeing a lot of the stuff that my dad went through when he was interviewing for the VA and, you know, other hospitals, and he would, you know, get crazy questions like that. And he always told me, you know, you keep a poker face and you just be prepared for everything. My wife had prepared me for these questions.
Yeah.
And so I was, you know, able to navigate the, you know, they're not fair, but stuff happens and you just have to navigate those issues.
Yeah.
And so I had a smile on my face and my background and said, look, it may be that your younger students need to try to keep up with me. So, yeah.
I love it. Let's go back to that statement about fair. Why is it not a fair question? Because residency is not the easiest. And I don't know, the older you get, you slow down a little bit, right? That's just normal aging.
Or do you slow down? You know, my dad is 77. He's had a, 54-year career as a pharmacist and has decided he wants to go back to school for a master's in physics.
That's awesome.
I don't know that you necessarily have to slow down.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, of course, we know what biology and physiology and all these things say, but I also believe that so much of what happens to us at any age is dictated largely by our attitude about things.
100%.
You know, for me, when I turned 50, for me, I looked at that as a chance to write a whole different chapter of my life, right? You know, I didn't have the happiest childhood, you know, came through, you know, some traumas, but now I feel just as vibrant and youthful and strong and energetic as I did when I was in my 30s. And
I wish younger people knew what our brains were like at an older age. I'm like, right. I feel like I could go back onto a college campus right now and fit right in.
Right. Well, you know, that's the thing. Like one of the things that I've admired about you for a long time is you appear to have this real passion for what you do.
Yeah.
And when you love what you do, then it doesn't feel like work and you feel energized and you feel like I can go and do this, you know, for as long as, you know, like I said, I look at my dad, 54 years as a pharmacist.
It's amazing.
You know, and I've asked him, like, when are you planning to stop working? He was like, well, if I do stop working, I'm going back for a master's in physics.
Yeah, you know. I don't know how much you know, and I may have some of the details of this wrong, but like the retirement system as a concept was a fake made up German thing because they had too many old people working and too many young people needing jobs. They're like, hey, old people, get out of here. And when you look at like the Japanese culture some of the Asian cultures where they're living vibrantly until their 90s, it's because they have purpose and meaning and they're doing stuff. And when the Germans invented this thing like retirements, it's like we lose purpose. And then what are we going to do?
Right. And that's the whole point. I think I've read that about how the retirement system came to be. But I have no intention to stop as long as I'm healthy, strong back, strong legs. I'm going to keep doing this. My wife is the same. She's just about to finish her second PhD now. You know, the two of us have started our own LLC. She plans to potentially even go to law school. She's mentioned that. So
Do you think you guys are chronic students? I've wondered this about just watching you from afar.
Yeah, you know, we definitely, there's a chronicity to it, but, you know, we just love to learn, you know, and, you know, my grandmother, my paternal grandmother, that is, was never allowed to go beyond a sixth grade education. And the one great regret that she had her whole life was that she was never able to get more education than she did. And of course, that was the times. It was what it was. But she always told me and all of my cousins, you know, when you have the opportunity to get as much education as you can. Now, one of the caveats that I'll give to people, I'm amassing degrees like people breathe air, but I'm not paying for these degrees. When I started my PhD program, you know, I told my wife, I said, I'm not going to pay for this. And I got a full fellowship for it. When I started medical school, I told my wife, I said, I'm not going to mortgage our financial future for something that I want to do. So I found a scholarship for that. I'm getting my MBA. I found a scholarship for that. I'm not going to pay for degrees. I recently got notice from the federal government that my student loans are now eligible for forgiveness. You know, I've been paying on them for a long time, and I'm not going to add to that debt.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And I love that, right? You have the opportunity. You also have family history, cultural history of not being able to get education. So you're trying to make up for lots of wrongs in this world. Yeah. I remember, I forget her name. One of my very, very earliest podcast episodes was a 50 something year old medical student who was a nurse forever. And she was a nurse because her father said, you're a woman, you're a nurse. You don't go to med school as a woman. And as soon as her dad died, she said, finally, I'm going to med school. And it was amazing. And I love that story. So that's fantastic. So you're in medical school, living the dream. Med school's hard. And you maybe have seen it through your wife when she was on the admissions committee at a medical school. And I've talked to many students, I'm sure you've talked to many students, about how hard it is. But you really don't know how hard it is until you're in medical school. What was that transition like for you? That good, huh?
Yeah, it's a different beast.
Yeah.
So what I would tell people, like, the science doesn't change, right? So like the biochemistry I learned as an undergrad is the same biochemistry that they teach in medical school. The difference is that instead of having 2 or 3 weeks to learn the Krebs cycle, that's a day, right? And you quickly learn that you can't procrastinate, because if you don't go home, or as our dean always talks about it, every day you get a stack of pancakes, right?
I love the pancake theory.
Yeah, the pancake theory, yeah. Yeah. And if you don't go home every day and eat your pancakes, that stack is going to go from 3 pancakes to 10 pancakes to 20 pancakes. And before you know it, you've got a stack of pancakes that you just can't.
Before you know it, you want to puke every time you think of pancakes.
Right, exactly. And not to mention, and he always says, we're also putting butter on the pancakes, you're getting syrup, and you're getting some eggs, hash browns, and some bacon. So you got to eat all that. And then, like I said, you know, coming in into this hierarchy, right? You know, being that I'd been the professor, I'd done research, I'd, you know, in fact, when I was adjuncting at ATSU, so I taught DO students in the epidemiology and bio, you know, so had going from teaching medical students to being a medical student in this hierarchy.
Yeah, they didn't care.
No, they don't care.
Yeah. How do you take that?
It wasn't an ego thing, but there have been times where faculty have said certain things and I'm like, hold on, that's not quite right. You know, because my wheelhouse is public health, right?
Yeah.
And I've heard some of the faculty say certain things. I'm like, you need to think differently about this. But knowing that I'm a student, there's a certain way that I have to express myself. You don't want to offend these people. These people are going to be writing letters of recommendation, you know, things that are going to go into your MSPE.
Yep.
And so sometimes you've got to humble yourself. Some faculty are willing to listen to things that you have to say. Some faculty, not so much. You have to learn which battles are important to fight and which battles you just need to walk away from. Yeah. At my age, I've learned that. Some younger students may not know that.
They haven't learned that yet.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of my very good friends was dismissed from our medical school because he didn't know that. He was challenging our biochemistry professor in open class, out in the open where everybody could see some of the things that he said. They were correct, but the way he said things wasn't the way you should do those things. That's something you do behind closed doors. You don't embarrass your faculty, you know, in open lecture. And he ultimately was dismissed.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just a quick note. You mentioned MSPE for students who are listening, also known as a Dean's Letter, the Medical Student Performance Evaluation. It's kind of like, think of it like a committee letter that your undergraduate committee writes, but it's coming from your administration at the medical school for your residency applications. Do you like it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's such an honor to be a medical student and study all of this stuff. I mean, it's a lot of stuff.
It's a lot of stuff.
Well, because I'm just thinking, because how long ago were you in medical school?
05 to 09.
So the amount of stuff or the amount of knowledge that we've amassed since then, I mean,
it doubles every like 60 days or something now. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. But at the same time, it's super interesting material. Going into the anatomy lab and being able to study the intricacies of the human body, just utterly amazing. You know, the chance to just learn all of this new stuff.
Yeah,
amazing. There's aspects of medical school that I don't like. I wish that it wasn't such a big hierarchy. Medicine is such a super conservative field. It's slow to bring about change, right? So okay, so here's an example. So me and my buddy Keith, we use ChatGPT a lot to help with studies. And some of the old school faculty, well, you know, back in my day, you know, we would just sit and read 190 pages in an hour. And, you know,
how I would respond, like, sir, do you use email? You do, because it's easier. You're not chipping away on a stone tablet, are you?
Right. But it's, you know, and I think one of the hardest things for me, so for years I've designed curricula, design courses, and then coming to medical school and seeing areas where we need improvement, it's hard to keep my mouth quiet at times.
Yeah.
You know, like there's things that I know we could be doing better, but I'm like, okay, this isn't my place to discuss these things, you know?
Yeah. Or is it? I mean, if you do it, as you mentioned, appropriately,
right,
your school open to that kind of stuff, or maybe not?
Well, we have what they call curriculum go sessions.
Okay.
And, you know, there's a mechanism for students to suggest changes. But as I've seen at my school, at my wife's school, other schools that friends go to, change is hard to come by. You know, I think one of the problems we have in medical education and maybe medicine, period, and some people would tell me I shouldn't say this because of my age, but sometimes when you get people in these roles that are too old, and not necessarily old in terms of age, but I'm saying if your mindset is such that you're not willing to change, if you're if you're coming into a situation where you're saying, okay, this is how I was trained, so it should be good enough for you, then you need to be out of that role.
Yeah.
We need to make way for fresh ideas. I recently read a paper that talked about how AI is every bit as good as human radiologists at interpreting images, radiographs. I don't know how true that is, but that's what the paper said. But my point in mentioning that is that medicine is changing. Medicine is going to change, and we need to be able to adapt and update our curricula and what we're teaching students accordingly.
And it's not just medicine. The world is changing with this AI revolution. It's incredible. The things that I do with ChatGPT and these other AI models, things that I would need two or three team members to do, or would hire a developer to do. I'm just saying, hey, ChatGPT, help me do this. They're like, here you go, here's the code. And I'm like, and it works. And it's incredible. And it's hard. I think, especially around medicine, right, where our end goal is to take care of patients. We don't want to jeopardize patient care at the end, right? And it's this one of the biggest struggles that I've had with medical education since I've been in it and around it is we're so stuck on tests, right? Everyone is teaching to these stupid board exams, and I'm glad step one and level one went pass fail. I think they all should go pass fail because they're licensing exams. They're not meant to be scored. You don't get a better license if you have a higher score on these step exams. But because it's easier for residency program directors to score people and rank people, it's just kind of been the way of life. But I think there's always better ways to do things. But I think we need some slowness, right? Because at the end of the day, we need to make sure people are capable of taking care of human beings at the end of the day. So, yeah, it's hard.
Right. Yeah, it's tough. But, you know, I think that we need to step back and ask, okay, is this the best way
100%
to educate students?
Yeah.
You know, like
it's the scientific method. What my hypothesis is, this is not the best way. Let's go figure out a better way.
Right. Well, you know, it's okay, I'm learning all of this science, memorizing all this stuff ultimately to take a test. But does that really translate into my ability to really think critically, particularly under pressure? And make sound decisions when I'm really in there with the patient. I mean, you know, way back when I was working at Baylor, I remember a lot of the doctors had that new generation, that first generation of Palm Pilot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you remember those?
Oh, I love that thing. Now, the handspring was the company behind it.
Yeah, that was the company, yeah. Oh,
I love those things.
You know, and, you know, doctors, they would just look stuff up, you know, on the Palm Pilot. And I remember one of the cardiologists telling me that I remember him saying, all this stuff you're going to ultimately learn in medical school really is for you to be able to pass the test. Your real learning is going to be when you come out here in the clinical rotations. Yep. And I remember him saying that what he prizes in his residence was the ability to think critically, to be able to know when they needed to ask for help or not, to know the limitations of their knowledge. He said, we can teach you a lot of things, but we can't teach you to communicate well, and we can't teach you
100%. 100%. Help. Yeah. The way that I explain it to people, if it ever comes up, is I think medical school teaches you to ask questions, how to ask questions, how to evaluate answers, and how to look up information. Yeah. And then residency is where you go and you learn it all, how to actually integrate it into taking care of people.
Yep.
What's the future hold for you?
Man, don't know. You know, I am most interested career-wise in family medicine or emergency medicine. My wife seems to think that I'm going to find my way back to academia. You know, she says that, and a lot of people have told me that they could see me as a dean of a medical school or something like that. I've developed a really strong passion for medical education. In fact, recently completed a study with some colleagues where we examined sexual misconduct in U.S. medical education, and our results were sort of striking, scary.
I probably wouldn't be surprised because it's everywhere, unfortunately.
And it baffles me that it's something that we really don't talk about or address.
Yeah,
you know, but you know, I just say that to say that I'm really interested in creating medical education environments for students to really be able to learn, to feel that they're truly supported without having to deal with a lot of this other extraneous stuff. But I don't know. I mean, I've also learned in life that sometimes the winds will kind of blow you, and sometimes they'll blow you to some pretty interesting places. So yeah. I'm sort of open to whatever life has for me. I just know that right now, as of today, I'm enjoying what I'm doing.
Yeah. I think it's very poetic how you just ended that. The winds will blow you to interesting places, which I think is exactly what happened when you went looking to go join the military, and you just happened to end up as a combat medic.
And that literally was...
and here we are, full circle. Daryl, for the student listening to this who may be in their 30s, 40s, 50s, thinking about going to medical school, what words of wisdom do you have for them?
I would just say, don't be afraid. If this is something you really want, pursue the dream. You only live once. You're going to get older no matter what, so you might as well pursue your dream. Again, don't be afraid. Embrace the change. Don't listen to a lot of the rumors, you know, that you hear about how hard it is and all these other things. It actually can be a very enjoyable experience if you choose the process to be enjoyable. And I've actually had a lot of fun going through medical school, and even the application process. It wasn't the beast that a lot of people make it out to be. Pursue your dreams.
All right, so there you have it again. Daryl talking about his journey to medical school, the ups and downs and trials and tribulations, and just everything involved in what the path may look like for some of you. And I think that's an important lesson that we learned today with Daryl. There's no one right way to get to medical school. You can go down a path and decide you want to do something and decide you want to do something else and do something else because you didn't think it was possible or finances got in the way or whatever it is. If you want to go to medical school, if you want to be a physician, let's figure out a way for you to do it. We can help you with that goal over at medicalschoolhq.net. We have a small team of amazing advisors ready to help you with your applications, whether it's your personal statements, your interview prep, your pre-med journey, your whole application, anything and everything related to being a pre-med student and getting into medical school, we can help you. Use the promo code PMY. To save a little bit of money. Hope you have a great week. We'll see you next time here on the Pre-Med Years.
This is MedEd Media.